Hi, this is Jean Bruce Scott.
And Randy Reinholz.
And when we're not busily producing some of the most outstanding Native American theater in Los Angeles,
we always like to check out the best of British audio adventures with Alex Lefchuk and his team of the Midweek Drive.
And Midweek Drive morning editions on Siren FM.
And Southside Broadcasting. Podbean.com.
Well, the time has finally arrived when we can actually welcome another legend of the wonderful world of film and television to the Midweek Drive. Delighted to actually welcome an ace soul who, well, let's face it, The Flash Season 4 would not have been the same without the awesome scenario portrayed by Donna Pesco. Donna, welcome to the Midweek Drive. How are you?
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, I mean, again, it's just awesome connecting with you, good self. And let's talk about The Flash initially, because I know we've got lots of other things to write through. But that Karen, Dr. Sharon Finkel, I mean, genuinely, I mean, you made that show, really. I mean, you need to come back. We need a whole series, surely.
Well, thank you. You know, that was such a fun character. And I believe they kind of extended it as we went on. I thought it was, you know, going to be one or two, and then it sort of grew. And then at one point they talked about crossing over to other superhero shows, but I think they just had so many storylines they had to deal with, it just kind of got lost in the sauce.
It'll need to happen, clearly. We need to actually address that there and make sure that the thing is sorted through with that, because, I mean, superheroes need you, Donna. I mean, let's face it. You know, the way you could handle John Travolta back in the day, you need to apply that to Grant Gustin and the rest of the cast of The Flash, clearly.
I love that. That's so funny.
You're based, of course, in Brooklyn and New York. You're now obviously in California and working through that. In looking at the career, I mean, it's been pretty awesome. I actually revisited Saturday Night Fever recently and watched the thing again. It stands up very well. It's a lot raunchier than I actually thought it was at the time, really. I mean, I don't know, perhaps we were so used to the music and the Bee Gees and various other bits and pieces. It's a fairly gritty drama to actually cut your teeth on, basically.
I totally agree with you. And I think as time goes on, you realize that the music, as brilliant as it is and as iconic as it is really secondary to the story, because it's a very strong and powerful film with or without the music. Obviously, the music makes it even more fabulous, but there is a real film there and there's a story there.
Yeah. I mean, certainly the tale of Annette, who I have to say, I felt extremely sorry for, because, I mean, she's given that binary opposition in terms of, does she become, I suppose, the equivalent of the Madonna or the whore and so on. And it's such a binary sort of contrast to work through. I mean, hopefully, you know, that, you know, we look back at them now from our perspective in the, you know, third decade of the 21st century. And it's just outrageous, really. I mean, you for a character to be written like that now, it would just be outrageous. You know, it'd be wrong on every count.
Yeah, I know. It's an interest. I don't think that film could be made now for a number of reasons, with all of the political correctness and just the general style that has changed. But that character I played, you know, I think everyone knew a version of that girl, you know, when they grew up. She was kind of identifiable in so many ways. To people that, you know, grew up in very different ways. But the soul of that character was kind of universal, you know, and I think that's why it touched so many people.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, music by the Bee Gees, which wasn't bad either. I mean,
pretty extraordinary.
Yeah. I mean, did you go through much choreography to actually go through those routines? Because, I mean, basically, Donna, your character, Annette, you would have been my choice. I mean, I don't know the other girl. She was fine, but she's too flashy. You know, you should have been the first.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, Alex. Dancing, you know, we shot that film in 3 months, I believe. And we shot it backwards. So the last part of what was filmed was the dancing, because we were all in training, you know, with the choreographer for that part of it. And, you know, I had never stepped foot in a disco in my life before that film. And it was kind of like, you know, going to another planet. And a couple of the actors and myself, not John, because he was too recognizable, went to the club prior to filming. And it was such a kind of revelation of the seriousness in which people, you know, addressed going there and knowing what they were doing on the dance floor. I mean, they were there obviously for fun, but, you know, the dancing was so fabulous from people that, you know, were not professionals. We really knew we had our work cut out for us.
But you coped admirably and more than capably. And again, it's well worth working through that. Did you have any particular favorite music from that time that you'd like us to kind of work through the process? Or was it just a case of, no, I was not into disco at all. I was more of an Ozark Mountain Daredevil gal.
Yeah, that Ozark Mountain. I didn't really, you know, I can't say I was into disco. I think I knew some of the music, but I didn't think of it as disco because I had never really gotten into that world. I was more into, like the Eagles and James Taylor and, you know, sort of rock and I think I even liked some folk at that time, you know, but mostly soft rock, I think, a little Led Zeppelin, but not too much, you know.
The classics, that's the important
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
I was a real radio album girl at that time, you know, so I really loved, you know, listening to whatever was near me, you know. So.
Sure, sure. Well, Up on the Roof with James Taylor, absolute classic ways from that point of view, which is great. Of course, when I actually mentioned that you're going to be on the show, one of our other regular colleagues in Los Angeles, Phil Linus, actually, who is a regular, actually said, oh, you must ask her about Angie and the sort of lines from that, because that, of course, didn't cross over the Atlantic. Sadly, we didn't see yourself and Robert Hayes in
really
in no a huge mistake, but you know, one of these days maybe it'll be released on DVD or something. But that clearly was a key high point in terms of series fun in the States.
Well, you know, it was a really strange time. That was a really sweet show, kind of a Cinderella theme where a sort of blue collar girl from the south side of Philly meets a very, very wealthy doctor from the Rittenhouse Square, which is kind of the Grace Kelly area in, you know, that very kind of, as they say, highfalutin kind of Philly. Yep. And you know, and they get married and it's the mix of cultures and all. It was really sweet. Gary Marshall produced that show. And it was on at the same time that Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley and Mork and Mindy. And I mean, he just owned most of the top 10 shows at that time. And we were very popular and we were in that groove. We were very, I think, much in the top 10 for the two seasons we were on. But Gary left to do films. And, you know, he started to have his major film career as a, you know, director, because he was so brilliant. And I think that show never really had a captain. I mean, we had several captains who kept leaving. Mm-hmm. I think that's why it never got renewed for a third season, because it just kept switching so many hands. And it was always popular, but then they would, you know, play with the time slots and confuse people when it was on. And
all the classic ways in which network television can actually kill a show. Unbelievable.
Exactly. Exactly. But it had a tremendous following. And even today, you know, I'll hear from people who really adored that show.
Well, it's still got a sort of, there's a growing body, I think, of folk in Hollywood. Maybe we should get a remake put together. We should get a remake featuring the whole thing. And
yes, and actually, why not? A reboot.
An updated version. And
yes. Old Angie now.
It will be fine. I mean, we're jumping a bit through the filmography here, but I have to mention Carol of the Bells, of course, because we spoke about this a few weeks ago, and we're delighted to talk to Lee Purcell, of course, with respect to that, who you featured in Carol of the Bells. That's a really groundbreaking movie. I'm really looking forward to actually seeing this, because for a number of reasons, I think it really addresses a number of key issues and perhaps shows the power of cinema and movies to kind of really impact on people's thoughts.
Yeah, I think, you know, it was very groundbreaking because Joey Travolta, who is John's brother, was the director, and he has been working, has a school and has a camp for kids, well, or young adults now really too, who have various disabilities. And he has introduced them to the film world and trained them to be really stellar crew members on in all facets and, of you know, what's needed to make a film. And this was kind of a dream experience for him too, because he got to use, I believe, 70 people from his organization who were, you know, slightly challenged. And I hate to use the word challenged at all, because they didn't seem to be. They ran the show. I mean, they had very professional people being the head of each department. But then the rest of it was all done by these young adults who, you know, have to deal with various mental and physical problems. But they were phenomenal. And it was the sweetest experience, because the camaraderie and the general happy tone of the set, because everyone was so thrilled to be there. And for me, you know, Joey is like family because of John. And, you know, I've known Joey almost as long as I've known John now, because when I first came out to California, I was introduced to his family and they kind of adopted me and we all became very close. And so I've followed Joey's journey into working with these young people. And I have so much admiration for everything he does. And he's such a sweetheart that, you know, they immediately, you know, love him and trust him and want to learn from him. And he's very good. So it was really important for me to be a part of that for two reasons. You know, one, to support Joey and all of the students, and also to be a part of this film, which is just so sweet and lovely.
Yeah, no, it's a looking forward to hopefully seeing that when it is released on overseas and all the rest of the bits and pieces, which hopefully we'll look towards. I mean, some of the icons and iconic television shows that you've actually taken part in. I mean, I have Ricardo Montalban, of course, in Fantasy Island. And, of course, Hervé Lachaise. Bas, Easy Plane.
Yeah.
Genius material from that. Of course, Trapper John, MD, and a whole heap of others. I mean, are there any that kind of, as you reflect on again, a substantial body of work? And also, I mean, Murder, She Wrote, of course, classic, The Love Boat. Are there any which you sort of think, yeah, actually, it might have been only for a week or 10 days, but that was a really fun experience?
You mean the Love Boat and
any of the shows based on? I'm just sort of in a sense.
Oh gosh, you know, I've been so lucky. You know, I must say that all of the work that I've done, I've always found something really spectacular to remember from each, and they're all so different. I mean, you know, you can do a four or five of the same show. I think I did four or five Love Boats, The people on that show were so much fun to work with. And, you know, they always had these sort of iconic guest stars, which I used to have to kind of keep myself in check from being starstruck, which I'm not very good at all.
They probably felt the same about yourself, Donna, thinking, my God, well, it's Annette, Annette from Saturday Night Fever. She's with us on the show.
I remember when I was at a, this is such a fun, you just brought this to mind. I was at the Muppets movie premiere, the first Muppets movie premiere, and they did this old-fashioned Hollywood style Klieg light, you know, red carpet, getting out of limos, and I mean, it was almost over the top, and it was over the top intentionally, and it was really fun, and everybody was in black tie, and Vincent Price and Maureen Stapleton came over to me and started telling me how much they loved Saturday Night Fever and my performance. And I literally could not speak. I mean, it was what I felt, you know, there are things that I was so blown away by these people, not only knowing my name, but complimenting me on my work. And for a long time, that was a real, it sounds so silly, but it was a real problem. I could never find my footing, you know, to just have a conversation and not just be a blethering, oh my God, I can't believe you're talking to me. You know? But that was the first time that people came to me, you know, that I would not point to and say, oh, look who's there. And I just never really lost. I'm better at, you know, at not blathering away, but, you know, I think there's always been a part of that that is still with me, you know, and I kind of like it because I have such admiration for so many people in this industry.
Well, and they for yourself, Donna, as well. I mean, that's why you were suggested to us several times over the years. We thought, yes, we must contact you. And when we have, and after last time, we thought, oh, it's going to be a silent sort of scenario. We'll just have to work on that basis.
Oh, that was so great.
Yeah.
If you would have seen me on the other side of the camera, you would have been hysterical. It looked like the Keystone Cops. I was pressing every button I could do. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. Wow. Anyway.
It's okay, we're getting there in the end. That's the important thing. Now, of course, you've also worked as a director as well, especially on the series Harry and the Hendersons and Even Stevens. Now, I'm aware of the Harry and the Hendersons series. Even Stevens, unclear with respect to that, but was that something you kind of always felt, actually, yeah, I always fancy taking a turn behind the camera? Because let's face it, Hollywood needs more women directors like you, Donna.
Well, thank you. Yes, I think, you know, I think now there's it's kind of opening up in a big way for women. You know, it's something I spent so much time on the other side of the camera, and I was always fascinated by the multi-camera technique, and I felt so at home in the genre, and I thought, you know, this is something I would really love to do. And when I finished, I think it was Out of This World was a series I had done. And I really thought about learning how to do this. And there's a wonderful director named Michael Lembeck, who is also an actor, who is also a friend. And in fact, I did in Fantasy Island with Michael. And Michael had segued into directing, and he was doing a show called Major Dad. Do you remember that show?
I have heard of it, yes, in the whole Soul Systems, indeed.
Gerald McCraney. It was just a very popular show. Anyway, he was directing, and I was talking to him about learning how, and he said, well, come and spend some time here, and I will teach you. And I spent a season on that show behind the camp, just really learning how to do it. Mm. And then from there, it kind of took off. But it was still at the time where women directors were not working all that much. And because I remember someone said to me, a producer said to me, oh, so you're giving up acting to direct? And I said, no. And for some reason that confused them. You know, it was not like
Clint Eastwood, let's face it. He hasn't given up acting. Well, he still directs and acts.
Yeah. There you go. That's exactly it. So I think, you know, I had an easier journey because I was a respected actress, but I did not have an easy journey because I was a woman. And I, you know, I think that's different now, but it was a little tougher then. But I did get to, you know, swim in the pool a bit. And, you know, I think about going back to it.
Oh. Well, I mean, I think The Flash could use your help on season 7, season 8, et cetera. You work on that system.
Well, I could be their shrink. I could be their director.
Exactly. You know, in fact, I'm already thinking we should have a treatment that we can put to Greg Berlanti as producer. Actually, say it should be the Sharon Finkel television show. That's the basic.
Alex, I'm putting this in your hands.
Yeah, well, you could be the go-to psychoanalyst and relationship counselor for all of the DC Universe characters.
Yeah, you know, I think that would work well.
Yeah,
I love that.
Got to happen. Did you actually shoot that in Canada, by the way? Was that a Vancouver production?
Yes, it was Vancouver. Beautiful Vancouver.
Because that's something which, of course, has become really, I mean, I suppose really since the late 90s and the X-Files and so on, there's been an awful lot of shows that have kind of moved north of the border and shot in Vancouver and so on. Clearly, it's an interesting line in terms of how really Canada is kind of impacting on the Hollywood scene as well.
Oh, I think it's been for years. I did a film in Toronto a while back called Dead Husbands with John Ritter. And we did that in Toronto. And Vancouver is a very, very big spot right now for most of the superhero shows. I think a lot of the Warner Brothers shows are being produced there. And it's a great place to shoot because, aside from the fact that it's beautiful, it really can be anywhere. I mean, it has so many opportunities because of they have a city, they have the suburbs, they have, you know, and it really looks like, you know, anywhere you need it to look, you can have it, you can say it's Chicago, you can say it's New York, you can say it's Gotham, you know, doesn't really, you know, wherever.
Absolutely.
It works, and it's a real pleasure to shoot there.
And of course, recently, I see that you've been in Truth Be Told, the second season episode from that, which is interesting. I mean, hopefully we'll get to see that. I mean, again, just out of interest, have you ever made it across to the United Kingdom, Donna? Have you been into dear old Blighty at all? Did you manage to get over here?
I adore England. I've not worked there, but I've visited, and I always say I could live there in a heartbeat. I mean, I just adore it.
Excellent. Well, that's good news, Donna. You know, I'm sure that the campaign will be starting now to bring you back and
yes, please. And
that's excellent.
Call the president of the West End.
Yeah. We shall do our best to actually sort those things. I mean, obviously, there's a little thing called the pandemic at present, which is kind of holding things off in terms of theatre stuff and various other bits and pieces.
Yeah.
I've heard of it in the States, I think, globally.
Oh, that's terrible.
We're coping, shall we say, as indeed most of us are from that perspective. And indeed, just talking about, you know, the dreaded C word, the COVID-19 and so on, has it impacted hugely on your own kind of day-by-day existence?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I pretty much, unless I'm absolutely in need of something, I don't really go. I go to the market. I worked, you know, interestingly enough, when I did Truth Be Told, which was fairly recently, you know, they were very, very strict about COVID rules. I think I took 5 tests while I was there within 1 week. And social distancing and everyone is masked. And, you know, there's a tremendous amount of safety precaution taken. And it's very different working in that environment, because part of the fun, I think, when you do a film or, you know, a TV show, is you get to know people, you spend time with them, you have lunch with them, you sit with them between, you know, scenes. None of that happens now. You know, you kind of are separated and put in safe little areas and all, which is great because you're you know, being secure. But it does take part of the fun away, you know. And now there's very little. I think it's starting to get back up again. But they, you know, there was a surge, so they kind of stopped everything once more. So I don't know. I'm supposed to go back at some point to that show, but I'm not sure when. I don't even know if they're back up yet.
Well, again, I suppose the old line, maybe we live in interesting times, and certainly we are.
We do.
And we carry on from that. Now, as somebody who was born and raised in Brooklyn, I mean, in a sense, I'm one of those folk who still kind of gets all his thoughts about Brooklyn from movies like West Side Story, Neil Diamond and the Jazz Singer, TV series like Kojak and so on. And actually we have a semi-regular contributor who's a New York taxi driver called Peter Franklin, who every so often sort of contributes his thoughts on the world and the universe and so on. But in terms of Brooklyn itself, I mean, is there something unique to that particular island, that particular district of New York that actually gives a certain attitude which helps succeed in life? Or is it a case of, no, it's much better if we actually went to Queens or another sort of island?
That's a really good question. Brooklyn's very big, first of all. It's almost a city in itself. So there's so many different places in Brooklyn. And oddly enough, people that live in Brooklyn rarely, I won't say rarely move out of their area into another area of Brooklyn, but usually people stay where they've grown up for the most part, if you stay in Brooklyn. But Brooklyn's been very gentrified over, you know, the last 20 years or so. I think what it offers people, and I can only speak for myself, is, you know, there's a real reality check, I think, when you live in New York anyway. But when you live in the boroughs, which is, you know, of course, Brooklyn or Queens, there's a real mix of people, and there's a real no BS kind of attitude. Wow. And I think you're more street savvy, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think for me personally, I just feel like I have a better sense of what a person is really like versus what they'd like you to think they are.
Oh, you can read behind the veil. You can actually go beyond that sort of system.
Yeah. I think so. So, but I think it's a great place. I think Brooklyn, when I was growing up, offered, neighborhoods where people were friendly and great restaurants and, public schools were really good. And you had opportunity and you had dreams and, I wanted to be an actress. I can't remember not wanting to, so the minute I graduated high school, I went to Manhattan to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. And the whole Broadway scene was there. I mean, it's a link to New York and to the theater. For me, it was a phenomenal start. It really was.
I was going to mention the American Academy of Dramatic Arts because that's very much in the sort of line, I suppose, of my old alumni Lambda, the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Arts and so on. But it all connects together within that. And again, it's interesting. We see the way that these variations in terms of technique will work through from the kind of Strasbourg approach to the Stanislavski to the Brechtian distanciation and so on. I often say to students, actually, that the one thing that acting will actually train you in is a good technique. And so far as there are certain actors who will turn around and say, actually, we're instinctual actresses or actors, we work on instinct alone. But actually, sometimes having that technique to fall back on can be quite useful. I mean, I don't know, is that your own experience in terms
of? I think it's great to, I studied with fabulous teachers at the Academy and everyone had their own style of teaching. And I think, of course, Stanislavski method and all of that, is always kind of at the root, a truthful. But I was also trained with some, classical material and, Shakespeare and Greek. And then after I graduated the Academy, I studied with Lee Strasberg.
Right.
So
yeah.
I think, you end up, when you work with really good people, when you train with really good people, you end up knowing what works for you. And you have, I really think, a technique that is a blend of everything you've learned that makes it work for you. Mm-hmm. I've worked with great acting teachers. There was a man named Milton Katselis who I worked with here in LA, and I was already a professional actress, but I'd go back to class. It was kind of like an actor studio kind of deal as well. I think you keep sharp by training and being around training, no matter whether you're a successful professional or not. I think it keeps you in check. It keeps you truthful.
Which is truly the essence of the whole shamanistic performance of acting in general, actually, living dreams.
I think so.
And working through that.
I think so. And I think good, there's such a weird thing going on right now between artistry and celebrity. And it kind of drives me nuts where I see a lot of very famous people that are famous for simply being famous.
It's fair to say, Donna, you're not going to be appearing on The Kardashians if they were to revive that series.
I won't. I have to say, I hope I don't insult anyone, but I've never seen it.
That's a very good answer, Donna. I think that's
I'm really okay with it. I just, that whole world is very mysterious to me. I just don't see it the way a lot of people do. And I don't think it's a bad thing. I just don't think it's for me.
Yeah.
I tell a lot of young actors, you really have to decide early on what it is you want. Do you want to be an artist or do you want to be a celebrity? If, there's a nice situation that'll happen and you can be both, or maybe you have no interest in the art. But that's kind of where I lean, and so I don't really understand that someone asked me how many followers I have, and I had no idea what they were talking about.
It's a strange and mysterious world, honestly. Just don't go there, Donna. You know, seriously.
Is there someone behind me? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that gets me is when you have Facebook and you actually, do you like something? Do you dislike something? Somebody actually puts up the notion that their pet has actually just passed away. Do you like it? Do you dislike it? You were shocked. It's just crazy.
It's so much work. It's harder work than doing a play at time, because you're dealing with personalities and people you don't know.
For me, I'm
just always so concerned that they will misunderstand something that I say, so I don't say much. It's a very odd part of it all.
I think you've got the right attitude, Donna. Just stay away from the tweets. Stay away from the followers. It'll be fine, you know? And don't get me started on TikTok videos where we're asking people to dance as well. That's ridiculous.
Darling. No.
So a couple of sort of concluding things, Donna, just to sort of wrap up in terms of the kind of, let's confirm the trivia is actually positive or negative from the side of things. They're all positive from their point of view. Is it true that actually, in terms of Saturday Night Fever, you actually had to audition 6 times for that role, 3 times for the original director, and then 3 times for John Badham when he actually took over the director's post?
It is true.
Wow.
I had never done a film before, and I was really just out of school. I was really a baby and very inexperienced in any of it. And I had done some off-Broadway. I had done a touring, but it was all theater. This was a very new world for me. Wow. And John Avildsen was supposed to direct the film at first. And there was really no script. There were some sort of loose, they call them sides, just pages that are, but John had us do more improvisational auditioning because I think he was looking for a certain essence and a certain believability.
Sure.
And so the agent I had at the time was so smart. I said, why am I going? He's just really into being authentic. It's a very small role. Don't even worry about it. She completely kept me in the dark about the size of the part.
Yeah.
And so I went in and I auditioned 3 times, and then, which I don't think is really unusual for a film, but changed directors. So at that, then I had to go and do the whole thing again, with John Badham when he came into play. So, and then I didn't know what the role really was until I got the part and read the script.
Yeah.
And then I almost had a heart attack. So...
You were more than capable of actually rising to the challenge, and you did, and that's the reason you became Best Supporting Actress as awarded by the New York Film Critics Circle, and Adonna. No messing about whatsoever. It is a tough watch. I mean, we've shown it to where we came in on. I mean, watching it now for a number of reasons, and as you said, you're probably right. It probably wouldn't be made in its current format before, because you are left with this very. Well, I suppose actually it's one of those, I suppose the latter end of a whole series of what were sort of fairly gritty movies. I mean, you can go back to maybe Midnight Cowboy. You can look at other sort of areas which kind of reflect on a part of life, which it's certainly not the escapist Busby Berkeley Hollywood musical and the line from that point of view, but it is actually sort of addressing a number of key points, both religious points, both points relating to life in particular cultures, and indeed, as I say, the way in which perhaps the only barriers we put up are the ones that are self-imposed.
Absolutely. And you just made a great point about Busby Berkeley musical. This is, I don't know if there is another film that is a dramatic film. Well, no, West Side Story is a, but I when it's dramatic and musical at the same time. So your mind is sort of geared to the story, and then the music lifts that, but it lifts it in the same way you would be hearing dialogue, and it's very different than that happy-go-lucky, gorgeous, singing in the rain, Busby, those wonderful musicals, which also have that incredible impact on your soul. But I think with Saturday Night Fever, the dancing was such an escape for these characters, and especially for John's character, where he was, this was the place he was allowed to be the, you know, the big man. You know, he worked at a paint store and was just a guy during the week, but on weekends he was the star.
Yeah.
And that was a just an amazing piece of acting that he did, and just, you know, tore your heart out what this man went through to try and feel like he was worthwhile.
Exactly. And again, it's something which I suppose that human condition is something which even today we still sort of, you know, grapple with that and hopefully
exactly.
wrestle with it.
But it's
part of that. Donna, we could talk and shoot the breeze for many, many sessions and so on, but it's been fabulous from our end. I'm just glad we can actually manage to communicate, you know, telephonically. It's great. Or at least via Zoom. On the positive side of things there. We do have two critical answers to, or critical questions to put to you. So I'll switch the camera on just to get the
volume. Oh, okay. All right.
Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today? Has it been okay for you?
This has been so much fun. I have to tell you, this is my first international Zoom. I haven't been Zooming for the most part. So as you could tell by my last attempt here. But this has been great. I've had a wonderful time talking to you.
Excellent. Well, the next critical question is, will you be kind enough to join us again? And maybe, as I say, be joined by a couple of either my students or indeed some of our other fine folk. Will you come back and join us again, Donna Pesco?
I will. And I will even, you know, throw in some lighting and get on camera for you.
Yes. Honestly, Donna, we know you are looking fantastic and absolutely fabulous. It's all great stuff. We know that's the case. It's a matter of course. Donna, as I say, we'll start the campaign, obviously, going to bring back Sharon Finkel. We need more Sharon
Thank
Finkel.
You.
Absolutely.
Yes, we
essential.
Need more Sharon.
Take care for now, Donna Pesco. All the very best, and we'll speak soon.
Thank you, Alex. It's been a ball.
happy wine tasting day. That's the opening lines, which you probably weren't expecting in this fine time that we're experiencing. But we're delighted to actually welcome to the programme today to actually talk about the importance of wine and other aspects as well. No less a personage than the master of wine at Black Tower. Of course, that's the wonderful Alison Fleming. How are you, Alison?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you, Alex?
I'm okay, just about. But in terms of this wine scenario, I mean, obviously, if you're a teetotaler, forget it. But in terms of obviously this research, it does suggest that certainly British men at least indulge with various sort of wine aspects on a regular basis, as indeed do women, of course.
Indeed, yes. We carried out a bit of research with Black Tower, and it does show that during the coronavirus pandemic in particular, we've seen quite an uplift in wine sales in the UK. That trend is very much consistent across the whole wine category. And both wine men and women are enjoying wine. In fact, about a quarter of Brits are enjoying a glass of wine with a meal every single day, which is really good for the wine industry.
Absolutely. I mean, of course, looking at nearly half of men saying that they like to read a book with a glass of wine, that could get very messy if you're not very careful. But I suppose it depends on the reading habit or the wine supping side of things. Were you surprised by any of these findings at all, Alison?
I think what's interesting that at the moment, because life is so very different, people are having to look for things to focus on and get into. So people are taking the opportunity to try new things, to learn new things, to develop new skills, to turn the newfound time that many of us now have into a positive. And if you think about it, wine is probably one of the most fun things you can have as a learning experience.
I mean, we've covered in the past, obviously, various connoisseurs, Williams House wines, of course, from the Williams Sitwell sort of branch, etc. There are all sorts of wines that actually are available. But in terms of, say, the overall side of things, are you finding that there's a generational shift here? Is there a kind of a shift between people who are over 20, shall we say, or in the over 60 bracket, etc.? Or is it a case of no, wine crosses all boundaries?
I mean, I think actually wine does cross all boundaries, but it's traditionally been slightly older drinkers who are what we call the heavy drinkers in wine speak, who enjoy wine on a more regular basis. But it's very interesting when you look at this, what this research shows, that Zoom quizzes, I mean, before Corona, nobody did a Zoom quiz, but now people are doing it. And in the 18 to 24 year old age group, 41% of all younger people are actually having a glass of wine when they do their Zoom quiz. So it really shows that depending on the activity, you'll still get all age groups enjoying a glass of wine. And it's really, yeah, it's becoming an important and everyday tipple for many people.
And are our palates becoming more sophisticated, Alison, in terms of obviously the choice of wine that we look for? I mean, are we saying, oh, I must go for a Black Tower one this particular time?
I think because times are uncertain and we're all a bit worried about the future and we're not wanting to spend too much money, we certainly look to brands that, or grape varieties that we know and love, that we know we've tasted before, we know they're good value for money, etc. So I think there's definitely that aspect. But the other aspect, which is really interesting in what this research threw up, is that people are doing things like these wine tastings online, which are organised by supermarkets or by wine shops, so that they're learning about wine, because we have got a bit more time to spend. And so people are actually getting, say, 3 bottles of wine sent to them at home and then taking part on this online wine tasting and just finding out a little bit more, because wine is a fascinating subject. I mean, it's been around for centuries, and there's always a story to tell about the grape variety, about the country that the wine comes from, about the winemaker. So there's an awful lot that's interesting.
And what was it, Alison, about the whole wine industry that drew your good self to actually reach the position of master of wine at Black Tower? Was it something you'd always sort of had a fascination for, or was it just a case of, well, it seemed like a good idea at the time?
I think I sort of fell into it, like many people do in their jobs. And I was in the north of Scotland at the time, and I got a job with a wine and spirit company. And that was when I had my first blind tasting. And I thought, I know there's a difference between these wines, but how on earth do I describe it? And that was when I just, my curiosity was piqued, and I just started to find out more and more and started to do all the various exams that you can do. And that accumulated in the Master of Wine.
Value for money, of course, is something which is key to most people's thought thinking when they're considering wine, etc. But I think it's fair to say, as far as I recall, that you don't need to scrimp and save on this particular thing. You really need to be sort of investing more than, shall we say, £7 for a decent bottle, at least.
I mean, obviously, we've got the lovely issue of wine tax. And so about at least £3, a little bit more, of every bottle of wine is either excise duty or VAT. So there's a big amount of a £5 bottle of wine is, of course, duty. But even at £5, you're still getting a really sound wine. The quality of winemaking has improved over the years. And price is still an important factor for many people. So the research again showed about 37% of people are looking to spend on average between £5 and £8. Maybe they'll spend more, so over £8 for a special occasion, but for sort of more everyday drinking, between £5 and £8 is a good, you feel sort of safe at that price point.
And where would you actually suggest people should actually go, Alison, to find out further details about things we've been talking about today?
You can have a look at the website Black Tower. So that's www.black-tower.de, which is actually also in English. But there's also, if you put into your Google searcher, put in National Wine Day, you can find out a little bit more. But just there's all sorts of educational programs, lots of magazines and books about wine. It's all around us.
And apart from obviously doing lots of radio interviews and Zoom interviews and such like, Alison, how will you be celebrating National Wine Day?
Of course, with a glass of wine. Maybe it'll be a glass of Black Tower.
There you go. Alison Fleming, Master Wine Taster at, of course, Black Tower. Huge thanks and happy National Wine Day.
Thank you very much.
The sound of your own wheels drive you crazy. Lighten up while you still can. Don't even try to understand. Just find a place to make your stand and take it easy. Sound.